Good Thursday morning to you. A little discombobulated this morning. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insights. What a Thursday it is. What a week it is. Wow. Fashion Week starts in New York City today. One of my favorite, used to be one of my favorite weeks to pick up women. Not anymore. Now I just read everything online and look at the beautiful pictures. And actually, I really miss when it used to be held in Bryant Park. New York City and Fashion Week, when it's not in Bryant Park anymore, it just seems like it lost a great deal. The vibe just kind of dissipated for me. Then again, I got married, so it really doesn't matter where Fashion Week is held nowadays, right? Olympics starting tonight. Well, the opening ceremonies are tomorrow, but tonight I think there's, what's that game called where you push it? It's like shuffleboard on ice. I forget what it's called. That, downhill skiing and a few other things. Exciting. Philadelphia Eagles, yes! Unbelievable. If you watch the game, you know, to me, you know, I was having this conversation with my producer and program director. He's got many titles around here, except he doesn't order me lunch. Jesse, our program director. I thought it was the best game of my football life. So, you know, I'm not a major, major fan. You know, I don't know stats, things of that nature. But to me, entertainment value, we're going to talk about that. I thought it was just incredible. And today, Philadelphia is living large. Their parade starts actually right now, 11 o'clock in Philadelphia. We're going to actually be checking in live to hear some, hopefully, semi-coherent fans that experienced the glory of Nick Foles and the legacy of the Eagles that certainly they were longing for a long, long time. We're going to meet an author, Professor Nick Tampio. He's written a great book, Arguing Against the Common Core. Are you a fan of the Common Core? I bet you're not, because you're a listener of the Progressive Radio Network. You know, why should we go along with standardized testing and what's dictated on a national level for students that come from different backgrounds, different cultures, financial backgrounds, etc.? One size does not fit all. Love to hear from you. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And when the drums go away, I feel like I need to replace it with something else, because I love that drum music. Anyway, oh, real quick, I have to give a shout out to my son, Luke. Real quick, he's been taking drum lessons for 3 months now. And chances are, if you are from the East Coast or you're a music head, you've heard of the venue, the Stone Pony in Asbury Park. Have you heard of it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Professor has heard of it. So he's taking part in this. Actually, as a matter of fact, the founder of this program is coming on the show next week. He's a highly successful record producer, John Liedersdorf. So check in our show next week on Thursday. The founder of the Lake House in Asbury Park. Long story short, they have a 3-semester program that leads up to what they call the big gig. And these students, depending on their age, actually all the ages, and he's in the youngest age category, play at, guess where? The Stone Pony, the legendary Stone Pony. So I don't know who was more stoked about this, my wife, myself, or my son. Actually, it was my wife and my family, because obviously we know the history with Bruce Springsteen, E Street Band. I mean, you name it, goes back. I mean, if it's a small venue, literally faces the ocean in Asbury Park, New Jersey, which has gone through, I think, the third and final gentrification. It's a great music town. As a matter of fact, the most popular T-shirt you can see around there nowadays is Music Saved Asbury Park. And so true. Anyway, so he did great. And it's just a great interview you're going to hear next week by a gentleman who just has music piped through his head 24/7, running through his veins. And it just, it's amazing what you can do and start and accomplish, as our future guest in a few minutes is going to talk about, in terms of giving kids opportunity. Kids with means, kids without means, when you give them the potential to succeed in something, whether it's music, whether it's arts, culture, yoga, boxing at the local gym, when you give them an outlet, it just opens doors that gives them endless opportunity. And in worst case scenario, it gives them confidence. So check this out. For now, how cool is this, Files? Not that I read a lot of baby formula jars or baby food jars, but obviously we are ensconced everywhere we go, ubiquitous with ads. But Gerber is obviously one of the premier labels for baby food. And every year since 2010, they've picked a new Gerber baby, or as what they like to say, Gerber spokesbaby. I guess there's not a lot of speaking going on, grunting, smiling, and diaper changing. Anyway, so pretty cool. For 2018, there's a new Gerber baby selected, one-year-old Lucas Warren. Now, what makes this so cool, that this is the first baby to be chosen with a disability. Lucas has Down syndrome. And I think this speaks volumes for the climate that we live in, the inclusionary environment, the landscape that's hopefully changing. Obviously, I talk a lot about this. I mean, this is something I speak about in schools and colleges nationally about disability and the fact that we all have a disability. It's what we do with our disability, whether it's real or perceived, and how we can, you know, through hard work and determination, obviously assistance technology, a lot of other things, policy, et cetera, we all can have a more of a level playing field. So very, very cool for the Warren family to have their one-year-old son plus a $50,000 check, which, you know, probably pay for half a year's of diapers. Diapers seem so expensive. It's like, honey, don't change that diaper yet because that's like a $10 diaper. He can probably go in it once or twice more time. So out of 140,000 submissions, Lucas, if you see his picture, Google it. He is just a cute, cute baby. And it's obvious that he has Downs, and it makes him even cuter because he's just happy and he's full of passion. And I wish him a successful year of spokes. It's a tough, you know, the timeline. You know, you got to go from flight from one continent to the next. I mean, it's a grueling schedule. You think the Kardashians have it tough. Wait till baby Lucas starts doing, you know, the red carpets and the step and repeat and all the award shows he's going to have to, you know, oh my God, he's going to setting the bar or the crib high for the future spokes babies. Also from the How Cool Is This file, we've all heard about Tesla and Elon Musk's company, and he's a pioneer. And I, like him or not, I take my hat off to someone like this, because where would we be in this lifetime without entrepreneurs, people really think out of the box? And I consider myself to be, you know, one of these people, but certainly nowhere near. I just like ideas. I'm a good ideas person, sometimes from conception, but more to make existing things better. And so when I read about just all the, like the Wright brothers, Bill Gates we'll be talking about, Michael Dell, I mean, the list goes on and on. These people who are just, you know, started with maybe, and this is actually really relating to our topic in terms of their education, how they were brought up, were they brought to think along the same lines, maybe in a common core way, or were they brought up educationally in an unorthodox environment, where it was bestowed upon them to think differently, read different items, experience things differently. So Elon Musk obviously launched a rocket into space on Tuesday. His SpaceX's Falcon Heavy was launched. And as a matter of fact, it's pretty cool. I watched my son, my 8-year-old son, shows me on Tuesday night, goes, "Hey, Dad, check it out." Of course, I had read all about the launch and stuff. And I was like, yeah, kind of half paying attention, kind of like one of those things, like if I get around to today, I'd like to check in. And I never did. But of course, he shows me this video, which was the number 2 watch video in YouTube's history, which says a lot. That says a lot, which is huge. And I love the fact that number 2, that so many people embrace this first test flight. And his goal ultimately is to man, to have people colonize Mars. And he's going to be getting close to Mars. I don't think as close. He's getting as closer, further than they thought initially, but I don't think as close as they want to get to Mars. And of course, you know, he had a stock his rocket ship with a Tesla. And not only does it have a Tesla in it, I think it has a matchbox version of a full-blown Tesla, because I guess you need to have a mini and a macro. I don't know, different size. But it's just very interesting. And but it makes me think about, and when I was reading about this, I had more questions like, does NASA say, okay, sure, come on over. Yeah, okay. When did they start talking about this? When was this planned? For 2 years, 3 years, 4 years? And how does Tesla, like, open its doors? Does he pay for all of this? Does he pay for the manpower? These are our tax dollars as well. I'm all for space exploration. But guess what, guys? I don't think we've gotten right here on planet Earth yet. We're getting better. We're more evolved. Hey, we have Lucas as our Gerber baby. That's a good thing. I don't think cohesively, politically, our United States is pretty much in turmoil. Hopefully things are getting better. Well, the Eagles won, you know, so anything's possible. You know, New England has been dethroned. Obviously, I say this with a wink, wink. But seriously, if we can't get along on this incredible planet that we call Earth, you know, with the Olympics starting tomorrow, North Korea is actually having, what is North Korea having today? They're having a weapons parade. I kid you not. Kim Jong-un is having a weapons parade. And I saw this incredibly humbling looking missile on this, whatever, platform truck. And I guess that's his way of saying we're ready for the Olympics, which is, I don't even know what to say. It's just kind of scary. Anyway, so I think it's great that we're pushing the boundaries, exploring different space and technology and all this. As a matter of fact, there's something I read the other day and I wanted to prepare for the show on this, but I didn't because I'm just sometimes absent-minded, that there is a car, and I think, is it a Tesla car that actually can fly? And I'm not kidding you, for 30 minutes at a time. 30 minutes can stay in flight. So for me, this is extremely cool because of my permanent visual impairment that's not going to allow me to drive for probably a couple, maybe I don't know, 5, 7, 10 years, if I'm lucky, another decade. So it's very, very cool. Between autonomous cars and cars that fly, I may be able to start doing drugs again, drink again, and not even have to worry about getting to point B. I just may not be coherent when I get to the Progressive Radio Network. Anyway, those points aside, it's kind of cool. That we are pushing those boundaries. And we're going to meet some listeners after we meet our professor momentarily. But I want to just talk very, very quickly about the Eagles game and, more importantly, the quarterback. And we're going to play a clip right now from Nick Foles. This is post-game. And just listen to his humbleness, his astuteness, and his humility.
You've had a unique journey here. What would you like people to kind of take from your journey the last few years and kind of be inspired by?
I think the big thing is don't be afraid to fail. In our society today, you know, Instagram, Twitter, it's a highlight reel. You know, it's all the good things. And then when you look at it, you know, you think like, wow, when you have a rough day, your life's not as good as that. Like, you know, you're failing. You know, failure is part of life. That's a part of building character and growing. Like, without failure, who would you be? I wouldn't be up here if I hadn't fallen thousands of times, made mistakes. We all are human. We all have weaknesses. And I think throughout this, just being able to share that and be transparent. I know when I listen to people speak and they share their weaknesses, I'm listening because I can resonate. So I'm not perfect. I'm not Superman. Might be in the NFL and we might have just won the Super Bowl, but hey, we still have daily struggles. I still have daily struggles. So, but that's where my faith comes in. That's where my family comes in. And, you know, I think when you look at a struggle in your life, just know that, you know, that's just an opportunity for your character to grow. And that's really just been the message. It's simple. Like, if something's going on in your life and you're struggling, embrace it because you're growing. I'm not really worried about my future right now. You know, I'm grateful to be a part of the Philadelphia Eagles. I said when I signed with the Eagles, you know, I'm grateful and content in this moment. I'm staying in the moment. I'm not worried about my future right now. There'll be a time and a place to handle all that. But I take a lot of pride in wearing the Philadelphia Eagles jersey. And I just enjoy being here. It's such a great team. I'm excited for Carson Wentz coming back healthy. I get to work with him every day, due to stud. And, you know, I'm just living in the moment, not thinking ahead.
Now, when I think of a professional athlete at a podium, when he's receiving such accolades, MVP, and even if he didn't, I mean, that's how a professional athlete should conduct themselves. Am I right? I don't know. I think that people to that level, to that degree, where, okay, Nick Foles doesn't have posters of himself on walls throughout America. Kids are not, you know, now they know, but 2 weeks ago, actually before mid-December, he's been a backup quarterback, I think, for just a year. And then he was at two other teams. He was at the Eagles in 2012, I believe, and he left. And he was questioning his professional longevity in the NFL. Understandably, because when you're always the number two guy, it's like radio. and maybe possibly being a professor. You know, you have to have, obviously with tenure, you have to have an available slot. And unfortunately, with in terms of TV, segueing to TV, with the fallout with the Harvey Weinstein, the Me Too, you know, there's been a lot of people getting promoted, likely and properly so, like Hoda, taking Matt Lauer's spot because a lot of these positions don't turn over. Now, going back to sports, of course, there's injury involved, there's contracts, there's longevity, there's a lot of different elements involved. But going back to Nick itself, Nick is, I think, somebody who's very humble. He understands the game, what's at risk, and more importantly, he knows what his job is. He knows how to curb his ego. He knows that if Carson Wentz wasn't injured, I think he pulled an ACL in mid-December, you know, he wouldn't be there. He wouldn't have, you know, got a touchdown. A touchdown, a quarterback getting a touchdown in the Super Bowl. You know, unbelievable. And the fact that he just composes himself with such moral character and dignity, and his ability to just say, hey, you know what? I had a lot of bad days, a lot of bad times, made a lot of mistakes. And you know what? We all done that. And sometimes a lot of people get very, very bitter and they say, why me? Life, the world is against me, and they feel entitled. And my message to you is that, you know, you can't give up on yourself. You have to keep yourself in play because, yes, you may be able to get the assistance and recognition from someone else, but you have to be your shining star. You have to be the person who knows everything about your craft, whether you're a radio personality, a professional athlete, a professor, pumping gas at Wawa, whatever the case may be. You have to be the best at your job. You have to be courteous. You have to be smart. You have to be thorough. You have to be conscientious. Anyway, enough of that. But I wanted to bring that to you because I thought that was very, very important, because in the day and age where I think there's so many deplorable people, especially with social media. I mean, look at Kevin Hart, the comedian, an actor who just made a disgrace of himself. He was there. If you didn't see this, I actually saw this happening. I didn't know when it was unfolding who it was. Kevin Hart is a big Eagles fan. I think he may be from Philadelphia. When he was on the field, I don't know how he got on the field, whether he had credentials, was trying to get up on the stage when the trophy was being awarded. And I saw a big, obvious security guard saying no to somebody, shaking his head, and seeing some guy looking up and basically like pleading with this person. It turned out to be Kevin. And Kevin apparently interrupted an interview and dropped an F-bomb on TV. I don't think it was the NBC broadcast. So maybe it was for B-roll or another carrier out of the country, because obviously NBC was the only authorized NFL provider that day. Maybe it was something for online. But anyway, he made a complete ass of himself. Now, here's somebody that could hurt his career, or maybe not, because if he's a comedian, he gave himself a lot of material. Was he shit-faced? I don't know. Was he acting? Did he do this purposefully to create material? So my point is, compare someone like Kevin Hart to Foles, Nick Foles. And there you go. And there was a difference. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Inside, heard every Thursday here, right on the Progressive Radio Network, live in Midtown, New York City, where it's actually a balmy 30 degrees across the states. And we're heard internationally as well. You can always check in at 888-874-4888. Now, this next guest caught my attention because he's written several books. His latest one called Common Core, National Education Standards and the Threat to Democracy. Rings true, right? I wanted to bring him in because Javier Perez, a great publicist of Page Turner Publicity, reached out to me. And as soon as I saw the subject line, I'm like, I got to get this professor in. Nicholas Tempio is a Fordham professor of political science and author. And this is his third book. And he's given a voice to parents and activists who think that the reform measure has made education and civic life a bit worse. And I have to agree, Professor.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Did you get an earful?
Yeah.
Gerber baby, football. Have we righted the wrong yet?
Yeah, I think we're on the track, right track.
Now Common Core is a natural segue.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I'm like a lot of parents who I had other things going on, and then I saw my kids' education being transformed, and I said, oh my gosh, I've got to do something, and I got to start researching. And I'm very fortunate that I have a profession and training to do research, and then I started to look at the Common Core, and then people often defend it. They say, oh, the problem's the implementation. The standards are good. So what I did is I read the standards, and then I read the scholarly literature about the standards, pro and against. And then I drew upon my training in the history of political science and philosophy, and I've come to the conclusion the Common Core standards are bad. They lead to an education that expects students to regurgitate evidence from a text. So all across...
Let me interrupt you for 1 second.
Sure.
But isn't that what most testing is about, though?
Well, I mean, the fact is...
Regurgitating?
I mean, it's No Child Left Behind Act of 2001. The federal government said that for states that wanted federal Title I funds, they had to administer standardized tests. So this is not brand new. And even before 2001, there was standardized testing. But the Common Core really amps up the entire school year for preparing for standardized tests. So before, there were spaces of freedom, and the Common Core is, you know,
took away from that.
Yeah.
Sure, because they're teaching to the test.
100%.
And speak about the origins. Bill Gates' name is behind this, very affluent, and I'm sure he had the best intentions.
I don't focus too much on intentions because you can't see intentions, right? So, you know, everybody can say they've got good intentions and you can't see them, so you can't disprove them. So, I mean, sometimes you'll read articles that say the Common Core were designed to, and I say, don't use passive voice. Actually, who came up with these? So basically, the short story is in the summer of 2008, this edupreneur, David Coleman, and Gene Wilhoit of the Council of Chief State Schools Officers met with Bill and Melinda Gates and convinced them to support their effort to write national education standards. So it's a totally undemocratic backroom origin. Basically, one of the wealthiest people in the world. Is he the wealthiest person in the world? I mean, anyhow, he's up there.
I think he's fallen from grace a bit.
Yeah.
He's two or three, I think, now.
Yeah, but anyhow, you know.
Fallen upon tough times.
Right. So democracy means rule by the people. It's not just for the people, by the wealthy. And so anyhow, you know, the fact is just the story that I view the Common Core through is the Emperor's New Clothes, that David Coleman and Gene Wilhoit sold Bill and Melinda Gates this robe. And now it's up to parents to say, hey, listen, you're naked.
At what point do you think parents, I mean, you're giving the book is giving people a voice, but at what point do you think, and do you think it's possible for parents and teachers and educators to rise up against this and or have the tide changed?
People sometimes ask me to predict the future, and I say, I'm not a spectator. I'm on the field. I'm playing. Mm-hmm. I'm in the boxing ring. I'm throwing punches. Whatever sports metaphor you'd like to use. You know, I cannot believe that an incredibly unpopular policy can survive. So political scientists talk about policy feedback, that once a policy is in place, there are certain things that make it harder to dislodge. So it's not going to be easy to dislodge the Common Core. And people who support it know that each year it's in place, it gets harder to remove.
Well, we can't even pass a budget.
Yeah.
And that's looming for midnight tonight.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And so... you know, the situation's dire, but I think the stakes are huge. I think this pedagogy of Common Core is anti-democratic. It's exactly the opposite of John Dewey's, mm-hmm. and I'm a John Deweyan. John Dewey says, really tailor the education to each child. So, you know, you were describing your son likes to play drums. Well, if you're a good parent, good teachers can realize, what are ways that we can draw upon that to help
tap into their interests?
Tap into their interests, right? I mean, this could be a tremendous opportunity. And what the Common Core does says there are these narrow skill sets, performance expectations in math and literacy and numeracy, and everything else is extraneous and can be pruned from the curriculum. And I'm one of the parents, maybe that sounds like you too, that's like, no way am I going to stand for that.
The percentages, I don't have them in front of me. I'm not going to hold you to these numbers, but they were higher. But obviously, educators are obviously more and more agreeing that the Common Core is not something that everyone should hold by, correct?
Well, there was a remarkable Education Next poll in 2013. The support for the Common Core was among educators was like in the 70s, right? There was, I mean, who's against high standards? I mean, I've never met somebody who's against high standards, right? But, and then in 2015, that percentage had dropped to the mid 40s. And, you know, I think the thing is people realized they were sold a false bill of goods, that the Common Core is not high standards. This language of college and career readiness is pure advertising, right? I mean, the Common Core was never a test run. It was written in the summers of 2008, 2009, started to being implemented in places like New York in 2012. There's no track record. There is no proof that this prepares kids for college or career.
So there's no way for us to determine whether SAT scores averaged below, higher?
I mean, I myself want to get beyond the test standardized test score as a measure of a quality education. I mean, think about all of your heroes. Do you really care what test scores Kurt Cobain got or Steve Jobs or Lady Gaga? I mean, I'm right. So the SAT is aligned to the Common Core. I'm sure the longer Common
Core,
Common Core is in place, SAT scores will rise. For me, that will just prove that kids have become better at taking the tests about the Common Core and nothing else.
What's the solution?
Well, I mean, America has this tradition of local education control. So we have this indigenous resource. We have this tradition of democracy, of ordinary people saying, hey, listen, we want a voice. We want a say. So, I mean, the best hope that I see right now is reviving the tradition of local control. How we get there, you know, has to be kind of an open question. But I mean, at least we have to be clear about the principle. Communities need a say in how to educate their children.
Is that easy?
No.
It can't be.
No. Well, I mean, it's, you know, there are a lot of us who have spent our whole waking hours,
sure,
it feels like, trying to think through this. One of the things that I'm very concerned about is this federal law called the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA. And federal government says...
How long has that been in place?
Well, it's the original Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965.
Wow.
It is LBJ. It's one of the pillars of the Great Society. And it says we're going to give money to states that they can dedicate resources to historically disadvantaged communities. And so that's a noble principle. I believe in that principle. But the subsequent reauthorizations really amped up the strings and pressure. And so the Every Student Succeeds Act has all sorts of stipulations about what kind of challenging state standards, and they must be measured in such a way you can come up with three grades, and they must be aligned with college and career ready standards, which has long been code for Common Core. So, I mean, one of the things that has to happen quickly is that the Elementary and Secondary Education Act has to be revised in such a way that the federal government gets more and more out of the standards testing and accountability business.
The Common Core does not apply to private schools, correct?
Well, it's a tiny bit tricky. This is something I learned when researching my book, is that, you know, a lot of private school students have to take the SAT or ACT. And if those are aligned with the Common Core, that's one way. That's also another way that homeschoolers are sort of being affected. Also, the Advanced Placement Program, the person who actually typed out the Common Core standards, the ELA standards, is this man, David Coleman, who I was mentioning earlier in the conversation. He's the head of the College Board. And so now he's aligned all the AP.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's aligned all the AP programs with the Common Core. And just what that means is that for all of these, there's this emphasis on close reading, which means, and just the jargon means, that you have to use the exact words from a text when answering questions about the text. So you're not allowed to add your own thoughts. You're not allowed to use synonyms. You're not allowed to make connections to other things you've read. You have to use the exact words from the textual passage. So I have a book chapter on the AP U.S. History program, and there's really that emphasis on that pedagogy. Read a 5-paragraph short informational text, answer 10 questions about it that require you to circle, bubble, or write the exact words from the text. And that's not teaching creativity. That's like, that's spirit crushing.
That's stifling creativity.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I think artistic, poetic, rebellious kids, I think that they're really going to suffer and are suffering in this current regime.
Well, that's the point, ultimate point is that we're raising kids who, not everybody should go to school. We need people to be in the trades. We need people to serve in the military, whatever the case may be. But we're preparing all these kids to go have the same trajectory.
Yeah. I mean, and one of the things that my principle is, I'm okay with there being different educational models. I'm okay with some people doing international baccalaureate, some going to Jesuit, some doing Waldorf, Montessori, outdoor school, French immersion, more vocational, right? I'm a pluralist. I envision a garden with lots of different options and people finding the option that's the right one for them. If some communities want the Common Core, I suppose that could be their right.
Do you think that's possible in a democracy?
To have a garden?
Exactly.
Well,
a la carte, almost?
I hope so. I mean, it's freedom. Hmm. It's freedom. And I mean, freedom is as much on the left ideal as on the right, right? That you want people to do things that inspire them. And one of the things I really show in my book is that a lot of communities in inner city Chicago, Baltimore, Detroit, they want local control. They don't want top-down reform. A lot of these reforms like Common Core, people justify them in the name of civil rights and equity. And I come right back at them and say, listen, that's paternalism. You're telling these communities that they don't have a say in how they educate their own children. Go climb a tree.
I was just reading yesterday that the graduation rate in New York City for seniors is up in this high 70%, which is the highest it's been in decades. Now, when I think about that, and then I think about something, an excerpt that I read in your book about how one kindergarten class, I'm not sure what year this was, canceled their play that year because, kindergartens have to work just like any older student about performing and memorizing lines. They canceled their play that year to prepare for the Common Core test. And how they felt like, obviously, and you feel, and I'm sure as I do, that that's kind of a disservice.
Yeah, that's a classic article in Valerie Strauss's answer sheet in the Washington Post. Kindergarten class colleges cancels kindergarten play to prepare kids for college and career readiness. Really? It's insane.
Reminds me of like Parenthood. You know, when the parents are talking. You ever see that movie?
No, I haven't.
You have not seen Parenthood?
No, is it good?
Professor Nicholas, you have to go watch this today. It's with Steve Martin and a cast of characters and his siblings. They're all grown and they're raising kids differently. One sibling's divorced and her kids are just running amok. Another set of his offspring. Siblings, you know, they're talking to their kid. They don't know what they're saying. You don't know how old the kid is. And they're talking about getting into college. And they pan away and the kid's like four.
Oh, my gosh.
And they're talking Chinese or anyway. Yeah. So it's in terms of the regulatory and how the environmental nature, nurture and all that stuff. But it's a great, great movie. You have to see it. That's yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my view, this is Dewey, is that take care of the present and the future will take care of itself. Figure out what fires up kids now and just tap into it and just ride the wave, right? If you're in fourth grade, I was in a school play. It totally changed my life. You know, if
being
I
got, a tree change your life.
I was Dr. Doolittle.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Yeah. And I was in the fourth grade play and it totally changed my life. And I suppose if you ask me to try to specify the direct causality arrows, I could give it a shot. But I don't want to do that. I just had a great fourth grade experience. I loved learning. I made friends. I got to practice performing on a stage. And yeah, I want more school plays. I want more field trips. I want more internships. I want more project-based learning. I think that communities should decide. And so maybe my vision won't be shared by everybody, but that's okay. I mean, that's...
How do you envision this? I know you're not a designer. You're an overall macro person who has a concept. But in terms of reality, you think each county or district... superintendent would decide and you can and then it becomes a busing thing and there's a lot of different factors involved.
Yeah, well, this is you have to be a little bit flexible and contingent about what kind of proposals you make. So the one thing I do make in the book is you have to change Elementary and Secondary Education Act. That's the key top federal priority. If you don't change that, everything else has got to be locked into place. But I mean, one thing is that in America late 19th, early 20th century, there were about 80, 90, 100,000 local school districts. So pretty much every school district was one school board and superintendent mm-hmm. for all the kids in one grade. So there's like three buildings or sometimes one building even.
Before redundancy entered.
Yeah, right. And even, you know, this past week or maybe, past week, Kentucky said that they're going to go down from 188 school boards to possibly, if this bill passes and Bevin signs it, Governor Bevin signs it, to 55. And that's exactly.
That's a huge savings.
Are you serious or joking? Oh, well, anyhow.
In terms of redundancy, as long as the jobs can be done properly.
Well, the question is that a lot of school board members do it for free, so the savings are marginal. But I see your point that there are ways you can do cost saving measurements, but part of the thing is that if you have school boards, you can either run for school board or go to the school board meetings and have your voice heard. When you're when you have these mega school districts that, you know, parents don't have a voice, and that's part of my critique of. You know, my concern about charter schools, right, is that they don't allow parents to have a voice. But I'm going to bracket that for a moment. I want to figure out a way to divest as much power as you can to the local level to make families and communities and neighborhoods as strong as possible and really try to get federal, for myself, even get states to withdraw a little bit and say, listen, education's better when it has the enthusiastic support of the people who are involved in it. And whenever you have somebody outside the classroom telling people inside the classroom what to do, you're kind of hurting the educational process.
So how do we get this in momentum? If this is something that obviously it has legs, and I'm sure it does because there's a lot of progressive parents. They don't even have to be a progressive parent, just someone obviously who doesn't agree with the Common Core. Do we need to get a senator? Do we need to get other politicians involved to make a state change locally and maybe have that as the footprint or the model state, as we were talking about the other state you mentioned?
Yeah, well, I mean, part of Here, I'll say how I fit within that question. That you're asking the right question, but we have to all decide together about how to address it. And this 1983 report, A Nation at Risk, sort of set off the alarms that said the only solution to America's problems is systemic school reform, where we basically same thing for everybody. One size fits all is the way to get out of this predicament we're in. They didn't use that language, but more or less when you read it, that's the legacy of A Nation at Risk.
I mean, it sounds nice. Looks good on paper, but in reality, it's not.
Right. So what, you know, we learn mm-hmm, from our mistakes. Sure. And now we say, listen, we need democratic education. And how we're going to get there, I mean, good thing to do is to make the Common Core a toxic brand. You know, I don't want to stay at that level because that's sort of just negative. But I mean, sometimes you have to be negative and just say, listen, the Common Core is not very good. There are other things, negative battles we have to fight too, about the next generation science standards, the C3 framework, which is social studies that's aligned with the Common Core. So we have to. First off, we have to alert people to what's happening. We have to convince them that it's a problem. And then we have to spur them to come up with alternatives. And yeah.
Do you think it would be a good idea maybe if they just started to maybe piecemeal it, like maybe only 2/3 were Common Core? Or I mean, we just kind of lose it all together.
Well, yeah, I mean,
it's like a trial.
Yeah, I mean, my hunch is that when people look back at the Common Core era, it's gonna be similar to how we look at bloodletting, you know, or leeching, where you just say, how were they so foolish to think that was a good idea? So, you know, I want my book.
Didn't think you were going to use those metaphors, but yeah, I got you.
Well, you think about it every time you go to a barber shop, you're like, oh my God, they used to drain blood out of people. That's why they use these things. So, I want the Common Core to be a totally discredited. I want metaphoric tarring and feathering of people. Well, shoot, maybe I shouldn't finish this thought, but metaphorically, not literally tarring and feathering, but, you know, basically maybe the reputations of some of the people who made these robes.
Nicholas Tampio is a Fordham professor of political science. His third book is Common Core, National Education Standards and a Threat to Democracy. Even just the name Common Core lends itself to mediocrity.
Yeah.
You couldn't come up with a better name. You know? You invented like the desktop Bill Gates and you can't, you know, contribute all that money and say, well, I don't think that name really resonates well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll make a connection to something.
It sounds subpar.
Yeah, well, you think about a Common Core as like a tree trunk, and you're just and I want a garden. I want lots of different educational models. I want things that people are fired up about. I want, you know, what Arnie Duncan, he sends his, he was Secretary of Education when...
I was just going there.
Oh, were you going to go there? Yeah. Yeah. Well, he sends his own kids to the lab school at the University of Chicago, where they really tailor the curriculum to each child.
And lab, like, L-A-B?
L-A-B, yeah, laboratory. And it was actually founded by John Dewey. A debate about how much it honors his principles, but really, you know, gives kids a chance to write for the student newspaper, to do internships, to do history projects and do field trips. And that's what I want for my kids, right? I think that a lot of other parents want that for our kids. And so I went to one forum with the state senator, and this teacher, she said, if people knew what was happening in the classroom, there'd be a revolt. And she's right. And the fact is that just so much of what's happening in public education and also in some private schools, too, and some Catholic schools, too, you know, they're just basically regurgitating evidence from a text. And you're thinking, what are the long term consequences if we train our young people to only regurgitate and say, anytime you step off the line, you're going to get zapped?
You know, it's funny you say that. And I didn't think about this until you just actually literally mentioned the word line. But my 8-year-old was criticized in first or second grade for literally coloring outside the lines.
Is that true?
That is very true. And I'm looking at my wife. My wife's looking at me, and we're looking at teachers. And I went for it right there. I'm like, well, you know, I mean, it didn't, whatever. I said something like, it didn't do the picture injustice or disservice or whatever he did. And he was actually a great drawer and everything. And it just made me think about, like, why? I mean, you know, I know it's a metaphor, but, you know, I mean, you're grading a kid on whether they stay in the lines or not? I mean, what is that really? Is that an auditory skill level? Is that a listening thing? And then, but now I want to fast forward to his third grade level now, where he's coming home with homework, a fair amount of homework. And I like the fact that he has to show his work in math, which is not always the case, correct, in Common Core?
Well, one of the hot spots are debating points about the Common Core, something called the Standards of Mathematical Practice. And, you know, I didn't know much of this until I started researching my book. But the debate in math is between those who think you should, young people should learn conceptual understanding first, or emphasis should be there, versus others who believe in procedural mastery, just getting the right answer and showing your work is done.
Just memorizing your times tables and just getting the right answer.
Yeah. And the fact is that both methods, word problems and pure math problems, both have advantages, both have disadvantages. And so, yeah.
I'm thinking the wheels are turning.
So the fact is, all right, so both have their advantages and disadvantages. And, so here's something I've just learned in the last few weeks, is that certain Common Core assignments require kids to show a lot of their work, which sounds like what your son is doing. I'm not necessarily opposed to that, although I don't think it's a slam dunk. I think the arguments for more traditional mastering of the standard algorithms, I think those have good points. But one of the things is that those kind of assignments are hard to grade. And
subjective?
Well, it's hard sometimes to make sure that all the students have come up with the right answers. That
like the following the dots, they do the same procedural.
Yeah, so you can really insist that teachers teach that. But I think there's been a shift in how Common Core is testing conceptual understanding, which is word problems. And because what word problems do ostensibly is that they test conceptual understanding, but they still allow you to come up with the right answer. And so basically, like the SAT, what does it mean to say that the SAT is aligned with the Common Core is that a lot of the assignments are word questions, lengthy word questions, where you have to find the correct things that they're looking for. So one that I discuss in my book is from a recent SAT asking how much laundry soap a laundromat needed to order, and given all of these variables, and about half the variables given in the word question were irrelevant.
So this just to throw kids off.
Yeah, just to throw kids off. And so, the student would have to figure out, okay, how do I diagram this question? Now, let me be clear. I'm not opposed to teaching that kind of skill.
Sure.
But the question here is that, it's not for everybody. I mean, what about kids who are learning English? You know, now all of a sudden they've given them, and say these kids who are learning English and yet are excellent at math, now they've been thrown this word question that, so they could be excellent at math and they could get this question wrong. Or what about students who are on the autism spectrum?
But shouldn't they be able to digest a question of that caliber? They may not be able to get it right, but
it should
be palatable.
Well, I mean, that's a legitimate question. I guess the thing is that in the past, there have been students who have been able to do well on math and poorly on English. And the teacher's able to say, well, you know, the student's actually smart and he's just learning English or she's learning English. But now they're getting poor marks on both tests. And
unless DACA doesn't go through, then we don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
And then, you know, there's also a similar dynamic in this is like for kids on the autism spectrum. Some of them are outstanding at math, and yet they also have a tough time doing the linguistic decoding. Mm-hmm. So let me be clear. I don't want to write the new Common Core, right? I don't want to come up with
You're proposing the concepts and to rethink the process.
Well, I'm saying, you know, if there are some places that want to try more conceptual understanding and see how that goes, and some schools that do more of a procedural understanding, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with New York and Mississippi having different education standards.
Well, you know, this is a good barometer here. You're a professor of poli-sci at Fordham University, a very respectable institution. Now, at poli-sci, are you getting students most commonly first 2 years of college?
I get first, second, third, and fourth year students. Yeah, I get a good mix.
So talk about what you've seen difference. How long have you been a professor there?
So I've been teaching from about 2000.
That's a long time.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I got my degree at Johns Hopkins. So I started teaching at Johns Hopkins like right before No Child Left Behind. And it's hard to see because there's certain methods you should do if you want to try to be consistent.
But in terms of just your intellect, in terms of the conversation, the dialogues, obviously poli-sci, there's a lot of dialogue exchange in class, correct?
Yes, there is.
Thoughts? I mean, are you walking out of there 5 years ago compared to today thinking like, wow, I think we're getting a smarter level of thinking coming up the ranks, or they're more cerebral, they're better at writing?
Here's one thing I've noticed. When I started teaching, I had kids with like leather jackets and punk rock pins. I had kids who were dressed as hippies. I had kids who dressed a little bit different and acted a little bit different and were, from a distance, you could tell, okay, this kid's walking to the beat of his or her own drummer, that they're different. And that percentage of students who do that is shrinking almost to negligible numbers, that all the students dress professionally or dress like Gap. And, you know, now, first off, I dress professionally and wear the Gap. So it's not like I'm trying to throw the kids under the bus, but I'm just saying that the kids who are free thinkers, and there's actually a German concept of free thinking, but anyhow, like the free thinkers is shrinking. There's not so much. And, you know, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus.
No, of course not. But I mean, obviously you are, you know, ensconced in this environment.
Yeah.
And so when you hear these students articulate questions, or one of your jobs as a professor is to provoke thought.
Yeah.
Right? Especially in poli-sci. I remember my professor in poli-sci, I was like, that's a class I never wanted to miss.
Yeah,
because
good.
This guy was kind of a renegade, and I loved it. And not that I grew up in an environment that was stifled creativity. I've always been kind of a rebel because of my disability. I've always had to do things differently, so I never fit in the classroom. Traditional classroom setting, I couldn't conform just because I physically couldn't. So I really tapped into a setting like that, and I would always appreciate when he would butt heads and purposefully try to provoke people to think differently, to ask questions. And so when I pose that question to you, do you find that there are more followers?
So first off, I like my students. And I think that there's an energy of creativity and freedom that wants to come out. So they're not crushed students, but I also think that sometimes they are suffering. There was an article with them in a Long Island newspaper talking to valedictorians about the Common Core, and one of them said it suppresses freedom of thinking and boxes you into a certain way of thinking. And I think that's right. Just on a day-to-day basis, it crushes your spirit. And you know, we haven't seen the full effect yet because it was implemented in New York in 2012. But you know, I like that proverbial case of the frog in hot water. That if it just keeps going higher and higher, the frog doesn't jump out. Like, basically, I'm on the outside saying, "Jump out, frog!
Exactly,
don't get cooked. You're about to get cooked."
Has this topic ever come up in school, in your class? Common Core.
At Fordham? Mm-hmm. Oh, they love it. They love to talk about it.
And what's their overall opinion?
Well, I mean, I have to tread carefully because I really the way I structure pretty much all my classes is here's one side, here's the other side, mm-hmm. you decide. Here's an argument for strong federal government with the best people I can come up with. Here's an argument for the local control, best I can come up with. If you ask me, I'll tell you, but you know, in a minute you're going to be out of my course and you can make whatever decision you want. And I'm hopefully giving you some resources.
And still thought.
Yeah, but I mean, the exercise that I do that really makes the kids or students their eyes light up is that I go to the Engage New York Common Core curriculum and I download one of the modules, and it, like, the module literally tells the teacher from minutes 0 to 5, tell the students to open their books and read the document, but don't speak. Minutes 6 through 10, tell them to define the words human and rights. From minutes 11 to 20, you know, ask them to see how the document is lined up on the page. Do not give them any background to the document. And, right, so it just micromanages the teachers for the whole year. And lest you think I'm cherry picking, this is the curriculum that's ostensibly or supposedly the most closely aligned to the Common Core of any curriculum.
Wow. And it's ubiquitous.
All across the country. Mm. Yeah, all across the country.
We'll have to leave it there. Common Core, National Education Standards and the Threat to Democracy, authored by Professor Nicholas Tampio. Do you have a website?
I do. Check if you Google me, Nicholas Tampio, my homepage will pop up.
All right. So let's try to get that in the works. And the conversation continues here. And Nicholas, stay around because we're going live to Philadelphia, where the party started about 50 minutes ago. And Fran is almost getting on the phone. He's not on the phone. Fran probably is being urged or tugged into a different direction, into a drinking establishment, or maybe a big float has discontinued his signal right here on a cell phone. But going back to your love of what besides political science? Is football one of them?
I love
you enjoy
boxing.
The game.
I enjoy the game.
Really?
Yeah, boxing was my sport. But I mean, you know, football's awesome.
Do you box?
I've retired. When I got married, my wife said I was done.
Well, you don't have to have contact, right?
Well, I actually do gym classes, white collar boxing, but you know.
White collar boxing.
Yeah, that's what it's called.
It's kind of like basically more talking about anything than doing anything.
Well, you know, I used to love to go into like inner city DC and Baltimore, and at a certain point you have to age out. So
it's a grueling sport. I mean, just the training, I think hands down, I'm a triathlete. I do spinning 4 or 5 days a week. I do a lot of different activities. I think hands down, it is the most effective workout.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh no.
Heavy bag, what's the speed bag, and just the plyometrics involved, and it's just, I mean, 1,000-calorie burn workout, no problem.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, in the olden days, you could take a medicine ball and slam it against my stomach, and you literally couldn't hurt me, and those were the days.
All right, we're going to Philadelphia for take number 2. Fran, how you feeling down there?
Dude, it's amazing. So many years in the making.
Is the energy palpable, my friend?
Right now, I'm the middle crunched between two buildings. They said they got 4 to 5 million people here. I can't see in front of me or behind me. I got my two little girls here. We're just having a blast.
How many years have you been waiting for this, friend?
Well, since I was born. When you're born in Philadelphia, you just learn how to be and enjoy being a loser. You know what I mean? Kind of like Jets fans, but not quite.
I kind of understand
similar.
You. The right? difference is we're not wrapped in green diapers at birth.
No, exactly. Exactly. You know, I wish my father could be here. This is a proud moment. We're just so excited for the city. Everyone's being behaved, man. Don't believe the media. Fake news. Philadelphia fans are the best.
About the floats. Have you seen any of the players yet?
No, I'm about one block south of City Hall.
Okay.
The parade goes around, and the parade's probably about 4 or 5 blocks away. It hasn't hit us yet.
What is the most, if you had one takeaway moment from the Super Bowl, what is the most memorable moment and why?
It's so simple. It's when Doug Peterson and Foles call that crazy pass on fourth down to score a touchdown. It epitomized just what this team's about and what the year has been about. It gets me goosebumps every time I hear it.
I just got goosebumps, my friend, in your explanation. I think the team itself just really rose to the occasion. The fact that, you know, their starting quarterback, three quarters of the way through the season, more than 90% of the season, is doomed, and they go to the number two guy, and he is the cream of the crop.
Dude, let's be honest, man. I got two little girls I'm raising in this world, and you know just all the crazy stuff that's going on with Hollywood and all this stuff, you know, the politics, just the way that women have been treated. And so these guys, I would want them to marry my daughter tomorrow. They're all really good guys. You know, they're just good people.
Fran, I just want to let you know, this interview is going to be archived, so your daughters may hear this one day, so be careful, my friend.
Yeah.
So the party atmosphere. Yeah, exactly. So the party atmosphere obviously is abundant. So everyone's convivial. The streets are crowded. I mean, is this something that you ever thought was really going to happen, or is this was just a pipe dream?
No, never. And for a lot of people that have been fans longer than I have, I'm 43. You know, my father's passed away 68. He never seen one. And that's what it's about. I mean, it's about, you know, you're raised into this. It's a birthright, and that's what it is. I'm from South Philly. There we go.
And more importantly, I think the message is, regardless whether you're an Eagles fan, the fact that, obviously, without a doubt, whether you like them or not, judge them. They are a great team, New England Patriots. But the fact that they aren't really liked. And someone who just composes themselves so well. I haven't seen anyone, all the media reports, all the TV interviews, all the radio, the fan. I can mention that because the internet radio. All the different players have called up have just carried themselves with such astute and high ethics, which is commendable to see. Hey, Fran, pay attention. Order your beer later.
No. Listen. Alcohol first, buddy.
All right, well, listen, you give those daughters of yours a hug, and you enjoy that parade.
Man.
Soak up every second of it.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the call. And, you know, we'll see you here again next year.
Do you think they're going to do it again next year?
I don't know. They got a whole Foles, and that's going to be tricky because Wentz isn't going to be – he ain't going to be 100% when he comes back. I mean, you're going to want to probably sit him. Maybe he had a serious injury. You're talking about maybe 1 to 3 weeks in the beginning of next year.
Mm-hmm,
you know, you can lean on Foles. So, yeah, they got to put a couple pieces together. But if they can keep it looking the way it is, I think that they're so young, I think they only get better.
And lastly, Fran, I have to say to you, going back to Nick Foles and his just incredible sportsmanship, the comment he made that he said he can't wait for Wentz to come back so he can continue to learn from him. What does that say about a person they just won a Super Bowl and after he got a touchdown?
I know.
You know?
I know. He is at the highest level of marketability right now. He's got the Super Bowl win. You know, this guy was going to be cut from the NFL.
Yeah.
And that was only –
And on his own volition, he was going to walk away.
No, he was. He was on the minister or whatever, but, I mean, it just wasn't going anywhere.
Yep.
He got cut, and a lot of people shaking their heads after that Super Bowl. And even against Minnesota, this guy's a player.
Fran, enjoy the day. Enjoy the win. Bask away and everything Philly has to offer. Thank you so much for your time, and be safe, my friend.
Yeah. Thank you.
So the party continues here, but it's going to be continued with Gary Noel, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like me to speak at your school, college, corporation on a lot of vital topics, check out my website, markfarrellmotivation.com. That's markfarrellmotivation.com. Special thanks to our guest, Nicholas Tampio, on his great Common Core book. And I will speak to you next week with a great founder of Lakeside, John Liederstorff. We'll be here. Take care. Have a great week.